court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Well, Mike, you sound a little under the weather.
I am a lawyer and a dude, and I have the sniffles.
I noticed that. You sound a little bit congested there. You've been struggling with something, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. It was like a little head cold popped up. Maybe some allergies. I was helping clean out a garage. I think maybe some of those dust mites got me.
Well, Sydney just went through a cold. She already had the flu earlier, so this was a cold, and Charlie had the cold. It's a wonder I didn't get it, that Charlie didn't. She just sneezes right on you, you know. She doesn't know the vampire move. Justin's been trying to teach her the vampire move, but she doesn't quite have it down yet. It's more likely she turns and looks at me and goes, ah, right on my chest.
What's the vampire move?
You know, with the elbow, the crook of your elbow up over your mouth like that, like you're dabbing or something. I learned about dabbing from Still Buffering and from my brother and me.
Oh, if there was only audio or only a visual of this, it would be it'd be good. Yeah, but I'm not feeling too bad, just a little sniffle. So nothing, a little nip of the bourbon doesn't help.
Yeah, the old family recipe, huh?
Oh, grandpa's cough syrup.
A little whiskey will cure anything.
A lot of whiskey will cure everything else.
Yeah, about two fingers worth, just right. That's how you measure it.
Well, this episode, we thought we would talk about something that we've actually talked about quite a bit in this podcast, almost every episode, probably, in some aspect, for the most part. That's the Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay. I know nothing about them other than they're there, and they are the last word on whatever happens.
The reason I say we've talked about it in almost every case is because somehow they have shaped probably any kind of litigation type topic we've talked about for the most part, and some other issues too. So it's a very important topic, and we thought we'd do an episode that deals with how you get to the Supreme Court and who's on the Supreme Court.
You mean like GPS directions? How do you get there?
Yeah. The address is 1 First Street Northeast, Washington, D.C. So you just type that into Google Maps and it will take you there.
And first come, first serve. You get right in.
That's right. it's like an ice cream parlor.
How do they pick these guys? Where do they come from? What do you got to do to be qualified?
So, but
questions answered today.
That is the actual address, and that the building itself was designed by Cass Gilbert.
Cass Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan?
No, he was a famous architect. Oh. And do you know what else he designed?
The White House.
Maybe.
I don't know. I thought he was a musical writer, so I obviously don't have a clue.
He designed the West Virginia State Capitol.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, he must have started slumming it. He couldn't get any more work after building the Supreme Court Justice Building, huh?
Well, you got to think, our Capitol complex is actually very, very beautiful.
It has a gold dome.
It does. He actually, and I remember, if you know, this was in the news recently, there were some desks that he designed that were basically the desks that were for the five original justices whenever he designed the Capitol. And these walnut desks, sometimes referred to as Cass Gilbert desks.
Hmm.
And basically, one of the justices recently was using it in his home office at home and became kind of a big scandal.
Yeah, I heard about that. I didn't realize the history of it, but yeah. I do remember that going on.
Yeah, so that was the whole big deal, was this was a Cass Gilbert desk that was at his house.
Well, and the guy had a $13,000 couch that was paid for by the state as well.
$13,000?
That's what I heard.
$32,000.
Oh, $32,000. Yes. Well, $13,000 is pretty massive if you ask me.
Yeah, the $13,000 didn't even cover the reupholstery of it, I believe.
Well, that's not what they go for at Value City, so I don't know where they're shopping.
Yeah, there was a big scandal recently with the West Virginia Supreme Court as far as their spending, and it's been kind of an ongoing thing. Most recently, there was some information that they've been having their lunches provided for on taxpayer money. while they were working.
Dishonest folks in political positions in West Virginia? You've got to be kidding me. I've never heard of that before.
Well, they're kind of...
What an aberration.
They're kind of an anomaly in that they're actually... They control their own budget. The money goes into the Supreme Court, and then from that point on, no one else has oversight on it. And West Virginia is one of the few states that has that. So I think that's probably going to be coming to a change at some point.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
But we're not talking about the West Virginia Supreme Court. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's good, because that would be too deep of a subject. Let's talk about the ones in Washington, D.C., where they don't steal couches and desks.
No, they. I don't think they do that. There's not been an investigative report saying that they do that, so I doubt. Article 2 of the United States Constitution requires the President of the United States to nominate Supreme Court justices and, with Senate confirmation, requires justices to be appointed. And this was the basis of the first division of power between the President and the Senate by the founders. And they said, basically, with regard to the President, he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint judges of the Supreme Court. And
all
that,
right.
That's the basis for the Supreme Court itself. Who was the first Supreme Court justice? Do you know?
The first Supreme Court justice, according to my study, was John Jay.
John Jay.
John Jay. Not John Jacob Jinkelheimel Schmidt.
That's what I was going to wonder.
That's what it sounds like you're leading into, doesn't it?
Did you see the little twinkle
in your eye? Yeah, I saw a little twinkle in your eye. You're getting ready to break out into that. That's my name too, right?
That's right.
That's John Jay, not the initial, but J-A-Y.
Okay.
He was the first one that was appointed, and the Supreme Court was brought about through the Judiciary Act of 1789. And what I thought was strange is it said that it was supposed to be composed of 6 members, though the number of justices has been 9 for most of its history. The number is set by Congress, not the Constitution, and the court convened for the first time on February 2nd of 1790.
So it's been in existence for almost as long as the United States itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 14 years short, huh?
I'd always, this was growing up and also probably being from Huntington, I think you shared the sentiment too that John Marshall was the actual first
justice. Yeah, that's what I'd always heard, that John Marshall, who our beloved Marshall University Thundering Herd is named after, that's here locally in Huntington, he was the first one. But according to this, from 1790 to 1801, there was 3 fellas, John Jay, John Rutledge — John must have been a popular name in those days — and Oliver Ellsworth. And they presided over those 10, 11 years. And about the only significant ruling that they say that they made during that time, the court's first docketed case — this was the first case before the Supreme Court — was Van Staphorst v. Maryland. And its first recorded decision was West v. Barnes. And perhaps the most controversial of the Supreme Court's early decisions was Chisholm v. Georgia, in which it held that the federal judiciary could hear lawsuits against states. Soon thereafter, responding to the concerns of several states, Congress proposed the 11th Amendment, which granted states immunity from certain types of lawsuits in federal courts. And that amendment was ratified in 1795.
So then John Marshall comes along, and he's pretty much one of the most prolific justices of all time, and also the most prolific college namesake of all time.
The winningest football team of the 90s.
That's true.
But yeah, he started in 1801 and was there till 1835. So when you look at those other 3 split up 11 years, and then John Marshall was there for about 35 years, that's a pretty good time in office.
Yeah, during his court, I believe they had all the big classic Supreme Court cases that really laid the foundation for the Supreme Court as it exists today.
Absolutely. He had several landmark rulings, such as Marbury v. Madison.
Right.
1803, and that held that the Supreme Court could overturn a law passed by Congress if it violated the Constitution, legally cementing the power of judicial review.
Right.
So that's kind of one of the things that you hear talked about a lot now, is people interpreting the Constitution. There's words that are actually there in what they say, but then there's other things that are kind of left open to interpretation, or things they didn't cover. Because, I mean, you're talking about a document that was written, you know, over 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So now you've got other things going on now. And that's, you know, we've talked about technology, how it affects things, and you've got to constantly update laws because of technology.
Things that exist in between the writing that is said to exist in between the penumbras.
The penumbras.
Remember that?
Is that the borders of the contract or whatever?
Well, penumbra comes from a Latin phrase or Latin word which means ghost or shade.
Oh.
So the blank spaces in between the words is where the penumbras. That's like the
shadow of the words.
That's right.
The shadow knows the true meaning.
So Marbury Madison sets up judicial review, which is basically the hallmark of our judicial system as we know it now.
Yeah, it said the Marshall courts also made several important decisions relating to federalism. Marshall took a broad view of the powers of the federal government, in particular, the Interstate Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause.
That's right.
That had to have come over from England, that the Necessary and Proper. There's no way that, because they were not necessary or proper then. The Necessary was a bathroom. Isn't that what that's called, the Necessary?
I need to visit the Necessary.
Yeah, when I did 1776, I'm pretty sure that there were some of our voting congressmen that were excused to go to the Necessary.
I've never heard that phrase before.
I'm pretty sure that's what that means.
That's a pretty proper way to say it.
That's where, it's necessary and proper. That's where I learned it from, was 1776. I learned a lot of my stuff about the Constitution from that doing that show.
It's funny you mentioned earlier when we started kind of talking about this a little bit, the one case, McCullough v. Maryland. And I always remember there's one phrase in there that's taken from it, and this is a paraphrase, is the power to tax is the power to destroy.
Yeah, so. The McCullough v. Maryland, 1819, it was a court that ruled the Interstate Commerce Clause and other clauses permitted Congress to create a national bank, even though the power to create a bank is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So there again, they derived that this was their interpretation from that.
So historically speaking, John Marshall, they moved the court and set it up in its present day, really, how it is now.
Right. And a lot of the things that were established law and precedent for so long were established in his court. And they said he was really a charismatic and influential guy, that he was only on the losing side of a decision once in 35 years. So he could pretty much convince the other ones what he wanted to do. And it was really unique the way they did it then. These guys would only convene for 2 months a year. And the other 10 months, they would go back to where they were from and serve in circuit courts and hear regular cases in circuit courts and then convene for two months and cover all the cases put before the Supreme Court. They all lived together in a boarding house. And they said that that John Marshall never really took any notes. He just sat there, and they would tell people, don't submit writings to us. Don't submit your arguments in writing. We want you to stand up there and orally give your arguments. So they would listen to these oral arguments. Then they'd all just go back and eat dinner and talk about it. And they usually issued their rulings within a few days. And what was really funny with John Marshall in particular is he would decide which way he thought it should go. Then he would influence the other members. And they said he was so persuasive and such a man of logic that he would lay out, you know, ahead of time before he'd approach him, how he would argue this. And he would lay that out. And most of them would follow along with him and go along with it. And so he would write up the finding, and then he would tell his law clerk, go find some precedents that back this up. So that's just reverse of what you do now. Now you look for precedents that you can build your writings around, and he did it just the opposite.
Yeah.
And there was a term that they gave to that because they thought it was so funny that he would send them out to look for the precedent after he had already decided what was right and wrong.
Yeah. I've heard of judges doing that before. So, you know, the whole history thing, it's kind of funny. It talks about how judges are confirmed to become on the court. But back then, there wasn't really a big whole confirmation process with regards to them. I mean, it still was the same way, but it wasn't as drawn out and in the media and as political as it is in this day and age.
That's because you didn't have fake news and you didn't have the liberal media there causing all those problems. Right. Just ask anybody. They'll tell you that's the problem.
Exactly. Just ask anybody. So in modern times, the confirmation process has gotten like a lot of lobbying, a lot of pressure from senators to confirm or reject somebody, usually depending on whether or not that person's judicial track record kind of comports with what that party wants or what that lobbyist wants. Oftentimes, that basically now, like, they conduct hearings that go on for days and days and hours, and their prior rulings are scrutinized from the bench. It's like, well, you said this in this opinion. What did you mean by this? You know, they'll ask me these questions about some sort of obscure case they may have ruled on 15, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and they're expected to try to, you know, defend their position on it.
Well, not only that, people change their mind over time.
Well, I think people, should be allowed to change their mind over time.
That's right. So you made a ruling this way 15 years ago, and now you ruled maybe 15 years later or something else. Well, maybe you've changed your mind. Maybe you've had an epiphany somewhere along the line, and so then you do that, and it's held against you, not being consistent or something like that.
Yeah, so they go in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they actually do the first interviews, and they give some sort of report. And during this time, that they usually don't want to try to give away too much of their own political affiliation or what they feel about certain things. So it almost goes back to that the Hamilton thing. Aaron Burr says to Hamilton that you're basically you shouldn't speak your mind so much.
Yeah,
you know, <don't>.
It's kind of like the old saying there. It's better to let people think you're a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt.
Exactly. Exactly.
But, you know, I'll bet when it started out that when they were reviewing people that they were looking for to be these justices, they were looking at people that wouldn't be pigeonholed far right or far left. They were probably looking for people that were considered fair and character, you know, character judgments about them and look at their rulings and were they fair and consistent and stuff like that. Nowadays, it all has to do with, are you conservative or liberal?
That's right.
And that's how you get picked by the party that's in charge or the president that's in charge or whatever, that you're going to rule in the favor they want. That just shouldn't be.
There's been a couple of notable Senate confirmation hearings and people who have not actually been rejected by the Senate that I want to get into. But I think before that, we have some pending motions.
Why, yes, Your Honor, or Your Supreme Courtedness. I would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right, approach. What do we have on the docket today?
We have on the docket our good friends at Sleep Number.
Right now, we have the Ultimate Sleep Number event.
Ultimate Sleep Number event. Sunday. Oh, no, it's more than that. It's more than Sunday. That just fit.
It does. So maybe you've considered a Sleep Number bed, but thought you couldn't afford one. But can you really afford another restless night's sleep?
Absolutely not, Mike. We have great news right now during the Ultimate Sleep Number event. You can save 50% on their Ultimate Limited Edition bed. That's half.
I'm going to have to check some numbers on that, but I think you might be right. The Sleep Number bed lets you choose your ideal comfort on each side, so it's the perfect bed for couples.
That's right. Then their newest beds are so smart, they actually sense your every move and automatically adjust, so you stay sleeping comfortably throughout the night. So if you start to roll out of bed, it'll flip you back up into the field of play.
They even have an adjustment for snoring. Does your bed do that?
We've established it does not, but my CPAP does. But it appears we're going to cover that subject every week.
It's my favorite bit. Sleep Number beds cost about the same as a traditional mattress, last twice as long, and 9 out of 10 owners recommend.
Come in during their Ultimate Sleep Number event and save 50% on an Ultimate Limited Edition bed, plus queen mattresses start at only $699.99. So you know what that means? If it's about the same as a traditional mattress, and you get 50% off, why, it's half the price of a traditional mattress.
Again, I'm going to have to check my numbers on that, but I think you're right.
Well, I was pretty good at ciphering when I was in school.
Ciphering?
Didn't fall in the cement pond.
Sleep Number now has over 550 stores nationwide. Find the one nearest you at sleepnumber.com/court.
That's sleepnumber.com/court. And have a good sleep and dream of Mike and Tommy.
Not creepily. So after these nominees go before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the whole Senate considers it. And basically all that's needed is a simple majority vote to confirm or reject a nominee. Prior to 2017, a successful filibuster threat could add the requirement of a supermajority of 60 if needed in favor of cloture, which would allow the debate to end and force a final vote on the confirmation. That's some Senate nomenclature there, that, you know, whole process thing that we're not really going to get into. But basically, you'd have to have more in order to end the filibuster, to basically force a vote.
Filibusters mean people talk and don't do anything.
Right, kind of like our podcast.
That's right.
So rejections are actually pretty rare, and the Senate has actually explicitly rejected only 12 Supreme Court nominees in its history. The most recent rejection of a nominee was in 1987 when the Senate refused to confirm Robert Bork. Do you remember hearing about Robert Bork?
I remember hearing about Robert Bork.
Yeah, it was basically his hearing confirmation lasted about 30 hours, and he was painted. He was nominated by Reagan, and the Democratic Party basically decided they were going to just not let him take the bench at any cost, and they essentially just assassinated his character, so to speak. He was like a well-known law professor and all this, and he was a conservative, but they tried to paint him as basically as kind of a closet racist. He was actually an appeals court judge at the time, and he took the rejection so hard, he actually quit the bench and stopped doing it. There's actually, if you ever hear the term borking someone, it actually means what they did to Robert Bork. So
I heard of porking, but not borking.
Yeah. So some people will say that basically the whole deal with regards to this politicizing the Supreme Court nominees and the whole thing that took place last year, a couple years ago when Obama nominated somebody and then basically they refused to even have hearings on him. Mm-hmm. This whole kind of party back and forth arguing over Supreme Court justices started back in 87 with Robert Bork. And that's kind of the genesis of where we're at now, that was kind of the first time that, you know, these kind of dirty politics came into the Supreme Court nominations, and they've just gone back and forth since then.
Well, I mean, so, I'm probably wrong to think this because I'm sure that these guys are guys of the law, but it almost is like, okay, if the Republicans nominate them, it's because we want you to vote conservative on any issue that comes before you.
Right.
And if the Democrats nominate you, then it's because we want you to vote liberal on any issue. And the judge needs to be able to weigh what comes before him and make a decision based on the evidence and not have this pressure of these people that put me here are expecting me to do this.
Well, they don't care once they get there. And
well, I know they're lifetime. Right?
And the record has shown that a lot of these justices, when they think they're going to vote one way on something, once they get on the court, they tend to kind of go their own route and do whatever they want to do. It's almost like they played some sort of prank on you to
kind of like Fleetwood Mac.
What do you mean?
Go your own way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
go your own way.
I thought you were going to say something about Rumors. I don't know where I was going with that.
That might have been the album.
Okay. But yeah, and what you have a lot of times now is these justices that they go before these Senate committees and whatnot, they don't really have any kind of track record because they're very careful not to put anything in any of their opinions because they don't want to get nailed down later on. So I think what we're seeing in the future is basically most of these justices that are going to be nominated are going to be very vanilla and not really have any kind of flavor to them. Although vanilla does have a flavor, but it's
vanilla.
Yeah. So maybe that was a bad example.
It would be like, I made the mistake one time of getting plain gelatin. Have you ever had plain gelatin?
I have not.
It has no taste whatsoever, thus it's plain. Plain yogurt is the same way. Plain yogurt looks like vanilla yogurt, but it's not. It's plain.
Well, but plain yogurt can be good, though.
No, it is not good unless you add something to it so it is no longer plain yogurt.
But it's healthy.
It might be healthy, but it tastes like crap.
I don't know. I kind of like plain yogurt.
The one that stands out to me about, talk about a person that was put through the ringer and then I can't believe that they were confirmed, was Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, that's right.
That is the one in my lifetime that I really remember because it was weeks, I think, his confirmation hearings went on, or at least it seemed like it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a thing where you saw a clip on the news that night. They televised those Senate hearings the whole time of what was going on with that. And that was almost like the O.J. Simpson trial and things like that, you know, that big, big events. And to have to sit up there in front of people and, you know, and the back and forth that went on and the subjects they covered on that, that was just, I don't know how somebody survives that and comes out and does it. And I would also say, I'm not sure when that was. It was back in the 90s sometime, I'm guessing. But I would also say that it depends on your period of when these things take place, because if that happened now, if you brought forth a guy and those accusations came up, he'd be done in the first hour of the confirmation hearing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that was in 1991, so it was kind of right after this whole Robert Bork thing, and again, was the basis for kind of when all this super, like, let's get into this person's backstory and see what's going on with them type thing started happening. Now, some of the allegations with Clarence Thomas, I mean, they were definitely more so also, I think, of a kind of a sexual harassment type nature and whatnot. Right. So definitely, you know, in this day and age, that would definitely not fly.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. You have to look at the era, because in 1991, that kind of stuff was not looked at the same as it is right now.
It was still looked at, but it was kind of, it was brushed off a little bit. Like, wasn't it Anita Hill was the...
Anita Hill, yes.
Allegedly sexually harassed her and
right.
talked about pornographic movies.
She was a clerk in his office or something like that, wherever he served as a judge prior to that. I don't know. Yeah. I don't remember what kind of judge he was or whatever, but she was a clerk in there and said that he had approached her several times and pressured her, and then also that he would talk about sexual things in front of her. And then there was the infamous pubic hair on the Coke exchange too.
What was that? I don't remember that one.
Something, there was a can of Coke or something, and there was a hair on the top of it or something like that. And he asked her, supposedly, what she said, he asked her, is that one of your pubic hairs or something to that effect?
Yeah.
And so that was made a big issue of. And, of course, he said that this conversation never took place. So yeah. It was, he said, she said. And
the one I remember, I think, had to do with him describing some sort of pornographic movie to her that he had seen or something like that.
I think you're right. And compared himself to the actor or something, yeah, didn't he?
The only reason I remember that is because it was actually a Saturday Night Live skit. And it was Chris Rock came in the room, and they was supposedly during the hearing, and said, "Who are you?" And he's like, "I'm Long Dong Silver."
Yeah, that's it. I was just going to say, I think it was Long Dong Silver. He was comparing himself.
Yeah. So I remember Chris Rock busting in and saying that. So
that is that's not the proper way to comport yourself. And like I say, in this day and age, that hearing would be shut in an hour.
Oh, or yeah,
less.
No doubt.
That'd be it. Time's up. That's what they'd say. Time's up.
As well, it should be. You shouldn't be doing that kind of stuff. So that's kind of how you get in, I guess, behind the bench, so to speak. That's the confirmation process and in a nutshell and what takes place and a little bit of history about some of the justices and who they were.
Is there any minimum requirement? I mean, I know you've got to be a lawyer, I would assume, but I mean, is there any minimum requirement as far as you have to have been at least a judge at this level or anything like that? Or could anybody, and I don't even know about the lawyer thing, if that's right, but could anybody just be nominated, you know, Joe Schmo, and he says, "Hey, I want to nominate this guy. He's always been fair. Let's put him on there."
Yeah. Well, I mean, you would have to go through the Senate.
Right.
And have that whole confirmation process. As far as like minimum age and all that, I don't know. I know, for example, to be like a judge in West Virginia, I think you have to be at least 35 and have practice for like, you know, 10 years or something like that. So I'm sure there's, well, I'm not sure. I mean, it might be one of those things that nobody's going to nominate somebody who doesn't have the very prestigious background to do that. So
I would be known as the maverick guy that nominated him. This guy's Mr. Fair. He's always fair in everything he does. Just like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, he always broke even on everything. So, you know, let's nominate Jerry Seinfeld.
What should we do with this bicycle? How do we determine whose it is? Cut it in half. No, do not cut the bike in half. And that's how I decided it was your bike, because you loved the bicycle so much, it had to have been yours.
That's right. See, there's a lot of wisdom in those rulings.
So the other thing that we're going to talk about with the Supreme Court is actually how do you get a case in front of the Supreme Court, and how do you get there? The Supreme Court basically has three different ways that you can kind of get into court there.
The front door, the back door, and the window if you're really desperate and you know somebody that'll unlock it for you.
And where is that court located?
Follow your GPS.
Yeah, one First Street Northeast.
There you go.
Go through the window.
That's right.
It's the only way to get to the court.
Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
Don't do that.
If they're dumb enough to let them,
that might be some sort of
eat a Tide Pod while you're on your way through.
That's true. The first way is original jurisdiction, and that basically means the Supreme Court can hear a case that's come to it directly without the matter having gone through any kind of preliminary rulings or anything like that.
So that's like original sin.
Pretty much, yeah. These cases usually involve disputes that are directly between the states, with no other federal court really having jurisdiction over the case. And these are pretty rare. And one example,
like one state would sue another state?
Yeah. One example recently was a case from the 1998 term, which was the New Jersey versus New York. And that was basically the Garden State sued the Empire State in the Supreme Court over jurisdiction of Ellis Island's artificially expanded landmass. So it was some sort of issue that dated back to the 19th century. So
I thought maybe it was that New York was going to sue New Jersey over their governor keeps shutting lanes of the bridge.
Yeah, he did do that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, these cases are kind of rare. And actually, there was a series of cases in 1971, and one was the Ohio v. Wyandotte Chemicals Corp., and the court actually declined to hear environmental pollution claims brought by states against corporations that dealt with complex and technical factual questions. The justices ruled that states have other available forms to bring their claims, and that the cases were not appropriate for the court in light of its primary function as the nation's highest appellate tribunal, and that the court resolved to examine seriousness and dignity of claims so as to preserve its resources for consideration of appeals involving federal questions. And basically, they've declined to hear cases between states, even where their jurisdiction was kind of exclusive. They said, hey, we don't want to hear this. We're basically an appellate court. So The original jurisdiction, even though it's a way to get there, it's one of those things that's like very rare and probably even something that's shrinking even less and less.
Well, I would think that this one that we talked about last week, where there's the 21 states that are suing, FCC?
Yeah.
That they're suing the FCC over the net neutrality? It seems like that would be one that would go to Supreme Court rather than a circuit court somewhere. I mean, who's to say they've got jurisdiction over it? It's a nationwide thing.
I would think that might be a good one. I haven't really thought about the jurisdictional aspects of that, but it seems like that would be a good one. I mean, it's state suing a federal government entity. And I think the problem you have if you have different hearings on these or different trials on these in different federal courts, you might get different verdicts. So I think you have a serious danger of having inconsistent verdicts with these cases. Well, you know, one court might do one thing, one court might do another. You know, like the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. We always talk about the Ninth Circuit always kind of does different things, or has a certain panache about it.
Certain panache.
Yes. So.
Well, and that also goes along with what we talked about in the John Marshall courts, where the federal coverage by the Supreme Court, you know, to cover those laws.
Yeah.
And the Commerce Clause, that's what I was trying to get to, the Commerce Clause, that he used the Commerce Clause as a reason why the federal government had the vested interest to make those decisions on things.
Yeah, and that whole Commerce Clause argument basically was used over and over and over again and kept growing and growing until it stopped expanding in 1986 with the U.S. v. Lopez case, and then it started kind of going back down again. So, but it was used, like you said, for many years for everything.
But to me, that's exactly what's going on with the net neutrality, that it could hamper interstate commerce.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely see how it touches on interstate commerce. There's no way it doesn't. I mean, the internet is not only interstate, it's interworld.
That's right. It's interweb. Al Gore invented it for that purpose.
Now, the most common way that a case gets to the Supreme Court is that it's actually already been heard and decided by lower federal courts or lower state courts, but it's been appealed by a party. So there's two different ways we have this. Basically, it's already been heard at the federal level. So there's already been a federal trial, and it's gone through the Court of Appeals. And then basically there's 12 regional appellate circuits, and then it goes through them and then goes to the Supreme Court.
All right. Now, would it go to a circuit court first, like that Ninth District Circuit Court, and then it goes to an appellate court?
That would be one of the regional appellate circuits. Mm-hmm. So that'd be like the Ninth Appellate Circuit. And so it would go to the trial court, which is the lower level, and then they'll go to the appellate circuit, which there's 12 of those, and then if it gets appealed again, it would go to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
So that's in the federal system.
So three strikes, you're out.
Yeah, pretty much. The Supreme Court, which is unlike the Court of Appeals, is not really required to take all cases. The party who is requesting input of the U.S. Supreme Court files what's called a petition for writ of certiorari. And the U.S. Supreme Court can either grant cert, and instead of saying certiorari, just say cert. Makes you sound like a pro.
Cert.
There's actually some different ways that people pronounce that word. It's spelled really strangely. It's C-E-R-T-I-O-R-A-R-I. And actually, there's a whole article I read when I was getting ready for this topic about how the different justices even pronounce it. Some say it's certiorari. certiorari, certiorari. Like, it's
tomato, tomato. We know what you mean. Cert. Just say, that's why they say cert, so they can avoid the whole thing.
That's right. Just say cert. So you petition for a writ of cert, and then basically the court will either grant it, and if they grant cert, then that means they've agreed to hear your case. It's usually granted less than 100 times per year, though, so it's pretty rare from all the cases that get appealed there. If the Supreme Court does not grant cert, then basically the decision of the Court of Appeals stands. But if they do hear the case, the process of preparing briefs starts, and the oral arguments take place very similar to they would have in the Court of Appeals. So the person who files the writ will have to file their brief with the Supreme Court, and then most likely the person who is against them would file a reply brief, and then essentially the person who filed the first brief can file a response to the reply brief, and then the person who filed the reply.
So what you're saying is it's exactly the opposite of the way the John Marshall Court was operating. They have already read a whole series of documents about this and are prepped for it before they ever walk in with the oral arguments.
Exactly. Basically, they've had you brief it out over and over and over again, explaining your point of view. So when you go in for oral arguments, they are well-versed and know exactly the questions they can ask you to trip you up and make you look like a fool, which is what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because then they know who's right and who's wrong.
Well,
whoever folds first.
They really want to pressure you on your arguments and put you in uncomfortable positions as far as, well, what if this or what if that? What if this? Where you have to say, well, I don't think this applies because of this reason. Or I don't think it applies because of that reason. Or I think, oh, that's a good example. Here's why it should apply. So there's a whole art form to that. It's kind of like dodging bullets, like Matrix style.
I'll tell you who to watch if you want a good example.
Who's that?
Judge Judy. She is in charge of that courtroom.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't let anything slip by. And talk about oral arguments. She asks you a question, answer the question. You know, and she says, I did yes or no. That's the answer. Yes or no. Isn't an answer. Yes or no. I mean, she lets them have it. She doesn't care who they are. Some guy that was supposed to be there as a witness in yesterday's when we watched it, he's supposed to be there as a witness. The guy was telling a story, and he said, Your Honor, that's not right. She goes, did I call on you? He goes, but the story they're telling is not correct. I didn't call on you. Don't you speak unless I call on you, but I just wanted to correct the story. She said, Bailiff, get him out of here. And that was it. He was gone. Walked him right out of the court. She's in charge. She knows how to maintain control over that. You get in front of her, she's going to get a ruling on you.
So if you were appointed president, would you nominate Judge Judy for the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. She's pretty old, though. I don't think she'd be there very long.
I always said I wanted to be a TV judge, and if I did, I was going to have one catchphrase that I always said every episode, and like people would be waiting for it. Like my catchphrase would be like somebody said something like,
"Book 'em, Dano."
No, I was going to say, "That dog don't hunt."
So that was going to be yours.
Yeah. Now I would only say it one time per episode.
Oh.
And I might say at the very beginning, the very like first minute of the case, or I might say at the very end. Or I might say in the beginning, you didn't know when it was coming, but it'd be like the one where the whole crowd goes, oh!
Oh, snap! Yeah, oh, no, he didn't!
Yeah, that's going to be my catchphrase.
Well, that'd be pretty good, and you could fake him out sometimes.
Yeah.
Oh, that dog just don't want to eat.
Yeah, exactly. They wouldn't laugh at that one.
And they would be, oh, it wasn't it. No, we got to wait. It's still coming. Hang in there. It's still coming. He's going to say it. And it would be on a t-shirt and everything with your face on it.
That's right. And a picture of a dog.
Yeah, we got to make that happen. Judge Wapner's dead, so there should be a vacancy for you somewhere.
You nominate me to fill Judge Wapner's spot on the bench?
Yeah, yeah. 5 p.m., must watch Wapner. Must watch Wapner.
Now, one thing that is similar to the John Marshall Court is that all the justices who hear the case will actually discuss it and then vote on the decision. So they still kind of do that. They discuss what they think is proper.
I bet it's not as civil as it was then, though.
Well, there's all kinds of rumors about what goes on behind the curtain there as far as which judges like which justices like which justices and which ones ask questions, which ones don't, who agrees with who usually and things like that.
But these guys, they all go back to the boarding house together, throw back a few beers, probably play a little Game Boy or whatever, PlayStation or something, and talk about the stuff. Did you see that idiot that was in there? Can you believe he brought that in? He's got to know he's going to lose, right, guys? Oh, yeah, John. Yeah, whatever you say, John.
Hey, hand me another Sam Adams. I'm sure that's what they were drinking back then.
Yeah, they had to. They didn't have any of the other things. Although Yingling was the oldest beer made in America. So
that's true.
I could have been having a Yingling.
Having a pint of lager.
Mm-hmm.
The Chief Justice will basically assign one of the justices in the majority to write the official opinion of the court. And then a justice may either join in that majority opinion, or they can write what's called a concurring opinion. The concurring opinion is written by a justice who agrees with the actual result, but maybe says that I don't agree with necessarily a couple of the points you made or in some of the logic. And other justices can actually join the concurring opinion or write their own. And judges that are in the minority have the option to write what's called a dissenting opinion, explaining why they disagree with the majority. And other justices can join in the dissenting opinion as well and write their own dissent. And in case, and this is a rare case, if there was a tie vote, then basically the lower court ruling would stand. So
they don't rehear it?
No, they do not rehear it. If it's a tie, then basically...
Tie goes to the runner. So whoever's a plaintiff should win.
Wrong.
Plaintiff's the runner.
That dog don't hunt, Tommy.
There it was!
So woo-hoo! The tie means that the person who petitioned loses. So,
oh, man.
That's why, like, whenever you read opinions and things like that, there'll be the majority opinion, and there'll also be the little dissent at the end. And when you're citing to law, you always want to cite to the majority opinion because that's what is law. And if you cite to the dissent, you know, you're usually citing to kind of something you don't want to cite to the dissent in your legal arguments unless you have to.
Well, that's what my catchphrase would be if I was one of them.
What's that?
Opinions are like belly buttons. Everybody's got one.
Belly buttons, huh?
Yeah.
I heard that a different way.
Well, I cleaned it up for the podcast.
So now the third route the case actually gets to the Supreme Court is very similar to the federal route I just explained, except this is an appeal from a state Supreme Court, which basically each state has the right to hear their own kinds of jurisdictional things. And you can appeal the state Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they can agree to hear such a case if they decide that basically the issue is connected relating to the U.S. Constitution or federal law or things like that.
Do you have to go to the Supreme Court, or is there like the district circuit court or appeals court or something you could go after a state Supreme Court?
No, state Supreme Court goes directly to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So that's it. Don't pass go, don't collect 200.
Yeah, because usually at that point, you've already had your trial. Most states have intermediate level of appellate court, so basically kind of very similar to the Court of Appeals in the federal thing, and then they have their state Supreme Court too. West Virginia doesn't. West Virginia just has basically the trial court, the circuit court, then the Supreme Court. We don't have that intermediate level.
And they don't get to decide if they're going to hear it or not? The state Supreme Court?
Well, it depends on the issues. You have a right to appeal to them for certain things. You know, for the most part, they will hear it. They might not grant you oral arguments on it, but they will hear it. So in certain cases, it depends too. In certain cases, you have a right to appeal. Other cases, you have to petition them to hear it, things like that. All the appeals I've been doing recently have been stemming from family law matters, and they basically, you have a right to appeal it to the Supreme Court if you choose. So I've done, I think I did 6 appeals this past year. It was quite a busy year for appellate work for Dawson and Meadows law firm.
Well, that's good. That's more work for you. Keep you busy. Keep that money tree growing.
That's right.
Keep it fertilized in the backyard.
One example of a state Supreme Court case that came to the U.S. Supreme Court was Broom v. Ohio, in which case Rommel Broom challenged the Ohio Supreme Court's decision to give the state a do-over of his botched execution. In 2009, correction officials spent 2 hours trying to inject lethal drug cocktail into him before calling off the execution. Broom and his lawyers said this amounted to a violation of the Constitution's ban of cruel and unusual punishment. So that's one example.
I wonder if the people he murdered were able to file that too. That it was cruel and unusual the way he murdered him.
Probably not.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's hard for me to work up much sympathy for him because I'm sure that there was a murder involved or he wouldn't have been on death row.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't agree with the death penalty, but,
Well, I don't agree with it for economic reasons, which is what we finally came to the conclusion when we went over that before.
There's no heart beneath your skin, only a dollar sign.
That's right. It's also rather arbitrary and capricious.
Oh, that's a good choice of words. One famous U.S. Supreme Court case was actually the Virginia v. West Virginia case,
yeah,
which involved whether or not West Virginia was recognized as a state. And
well, most people don't recognize. They drive right by and don't even recognize us there.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty interesting opinion because the Supreme Court basically said, yes, West Virginia is a state and is actually better than Virginia in every imaginable way.
What?
Yeah, it's in there.
Was he sober?
Read it.
That's where it came from. Sober as a judge, huh?
Better than West Virginia. Virginia is lesser to West Virginia in every imaginable way.
Well, Lester Holt tried to expand us the other night.
Did he?
Yeah, when that Amtrak train crashed on the way to the Greenbrier, but it actually crashed in Virginia on the way to the Greenbrier in West Virginia. And Lester Holt said that it crashed at whatever the name of the city was, the town in West Virginia. So he expanded us over into Virginia, so we get part of it, part more of Virginia there, I guess. If Lester Holt said it, it must be true.
I'm going to have to go ahead and say I don't know who Lester Holt is.
What? You don't know who Lester Holt is? He's the anchor for the evening news on WSA or NBC.
Oh. Yeah.
WSAZ is a local channel. NBC.
I don't really watch the news like that.
You don't?
No.
I watch the news every night. I record it, so if I miss it, I can come in and play it back.
I
have to know what's going on in the world. How do you know what's going on in the world?
The internet.
That's all fake news. Dude, the Russians are putting that up there. You read that, and you're going to be moving to Moscow or something, or living in Siberia or something. They'll tell you there's condos there to move into or something.
You know what is funny is that I bought my new TV, and I didn't have cable, but it was a smart TV with like high-def 4K, and it was awesome, but it had these apps on it. And I started searching the apps, and one of the apps it has for news was RT News, which is Russia Times News. And
there you go.
I'll tell you what, that was the coverage that was absolutely free. They didn't charge you for it. They were just putting it out there, and it was on all the TVs that you wanted. Like, it's actually kind of a brilliant idea.
Russian news is fake news.
Well, they...
Because it's what they want you to hear.
Yeah, but here's the thing. They basically put it on apps on TV for free. So they're actually getting their message out for free to people, whereas the other networks and things like that, who, you know, might not be less biased, not state controlled, you know, make you pay for it. If you don't have cable, you can't see it.
So I'm not going to pay for my news. I'm going to take the news that's propaganda.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the veracity of RT News. I mean, it is Russia Today News. And I've heard there have been some allegations that it's not exactly, it's slightly slanted to the Russians.
You think?
But
you don't say anything bad about Putin or you don't wake up the next day. Same way Kim Jong-un. They control all that is said there, too. Otherwise, it's some couple of chicks attack you in the airport and rub poison on your face.
What?
That's how he killed his half-brother.
Who?
Kim Jong-un. Last year, or I think it was last year, year before.
He had two chickens attack
him? He had two chicks come up to his half-brother in the airport in, I think it was in South Korea, and they rubbed poison on his face and killed him. You didn't know about that? See, that's what happens when you watch the Russian news. They don't tell you about that.
Maybe when I read it.
You need to find out. You need to call Lester up and tell him to sign you up. I was just going to say there was a couple of significant other rulings. As we go through time, it kind of amazed me. There have not been that many Supreme Court justices from the time it was established to now.
Yeah.
When you think about it being that long ago.
Well, I mean, you get it for your entire lifetime, so.
So you're there for as long as you can last, right?
Pretty much.
I thought it was interesting. They said... All right. In the 1930s and 40s, you had Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes, and that one of the things that they were faced with is the Supreme Court, the way that it was set up, it had basically five conservatives and four liberals.
Mm-hmm.
So this was at the time when Franklin D. Roosevelt was getting different laws passed, his New Deal programs.
Yeah.
So they were passing Congress and then going to the Supreme Court and getting struck down 5-4. And he was getting frustrated with it. So he got the people in Congress to introduce a bill that was called, in 1936, that was called the Judiciary Reorganization Bill. And it was also nicknamed the Court Packing Bill by its opponents. And the idea was he was going to increase the size of the Supreme Court. He was going to add more justices, and guess who got to appoint the justices?
Yeah, him.
Yeah. So he needed about three more, put about three more in there, and he names them, and now he'd start getting his rulings through.
That's a brilliant idea right there.
Yeah, but it ended up he had a lot of opponents, including his own vice president, who was a guy named John Nance Garner, and it ended up being defeated in Congress.
Well, I think that was probably a bad idea.
Then you had... the Burger Court, and not to be confused with Burger King, that was from 1969 to 1986. Chief Justice Earl Warren was succeeded by Warren E. Burger, and he served from 69 to 86. The Burger Court is most remembered for its ruling in Roe v. Wade. So that was who was there when they made their ruling in Roe v. Wade. He also had the ruling in United States v. Nixon, 1974, where the court ruled that the courts have the final voice in determining constitutional questions and that no person, not even the President of the United States, is completely above the law.
That's right.
So until then, they weren't sure about that, but now they've established that.
I think that's the right ruling.
You think so?
I think so.
No man shall stand above, because if he does, then he's not going to act responsibly, because we've proven as human beings we're not capable of that.
We need checks and balances.
Checks and balances.
Speaking of checks, I think brings us to
legal briefs. That brings us to legal briefs of checks.
Legal briefs is the part of the show where I check Tommy's knowledge to see if he's been paying attention.
I was thinking of a check, like money check. I was like, what, you going to pay me? Somebody pay me. I'll give you the answer you want.
It's time to get paid. So legal briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy some questions and check to see if he was listening. All right. First question. Who designed the Supreme Court building and also the West Virginia State Capitol Complex?
Name was something like Cass or something like that.
It's Cass Gilbert.
Cass Gilbert. Yeah, Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Had to double check, make sure that was right.
Yeah, I remember
he, Cass Gilbert, and he also designed desks, some desks too.
Yeah, that got stolen by our Supreme Court justices.
They used them.
Reappropriated.
They used them to work at home. They spend long hours working.
Right.
How many justices are there on the U.S. Supreme Court?
There are 9. Even though it was originally designed to only have 6, but for some reason they appointed 9 because it didn't specifically say, and they like 9. Why would you want an even number anyway? You need to break the tie.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, very bad, especially in this day and age.
Unless we have like some sort of, it's an even number, but then the president gets to decide that last vote.
Well, it's the vice president anymore decides most of the votes that get passed.
The Senate, yeah. So what are the 3 ways to get to the Supreme Court of the United States?
Front door, back door, and the window. Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you. It's at 1 East Main Drive.
You're sticking to that answer, huh?
You can have original sin, which is what we're all born with until we get baptized.
That's right.
And you can go straight to Supreme Court to get that removed. then you have like state-to-state things, or is that original? When a state is suing another state, and then if it's got to be settled, it goes to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's
that's under original.
Yeah, it's also First Communion.
Oh yeah, and confirmation.
Yeah.
All right, and then you have ones that have gone through all the way up through the appeals court, and once you've exhausted your appeals, then the last place to go is to petition a court to see if you can hear it there.
Right, and those are cases which originated in federal court, but then they've worked their way through the federal system to the Supreme Court.
And then you can work your way up through the state and hear before the state Supreme Court. And then if you don't like it, you can appeal to the federal Supreme Court.
That's right. You just had to work your way through there.
Yeah, I had to think about that.
You had to kind of balance your answers a little bit.
That's right.
So, that's going to do it for legal briefs.
Well, I have one for you.
Okay.
Who was considered the greatest Chief Justice of them all in the history of the Supreme Court?
Bring on the herd.
We are the sons of Marshall.
John Marshall.
Sons of the great John Marshall. That's right.
That's the Marshall fight song for anybody that couldn't piece that together.
Yeah, I didn't want to go through the whole thing. There's nothing in there about drinking beer or anything, though. That's a Sig Epps song. I almost got off one.
But you know, the interesting thing is that being Marshall University, we don't have a law school.
Well, that's true. We don't have a law school. I think we had one at one time, and they did away with it. And WVU is a... Yeah. Law school here.
It would be kind of a no-brainer to have a Marshall Law School named after
him. You would think so. Yeah. I mean, he's standing right out front with a book under his arm.
There is actually a John Marshall School of Law. I don't know where it is, though.
It's not here.
It's not here.
We're not him. Don't come looking here. If you're looking at how to find your way there, there's 3 ways. This isn't one of them.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.